that moment of dysregulation can extend for the rest of the day, even after you turn off the vacuum. So they maybe stop crying, but they might be on edge, they might be a little moodier, and then they might have like a big fear of the vacuum.
This is the Curious Neuron Podcast, where we take a compassionate approach to science-based parenting. Join us as we break down the science of child development and parenting into digestible and applicable advice. Welcome.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Curious Neuron Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. That was my six-year-old, and she wanted to come and say hello and work with me a little bit tonight as I'm recording the intro to today's episode. What a nice way to start the episode. Maybe if you like it, let me know. We'll start it every episode, and I'll bring in the other kids too. I'd like to thank a mom that is from the Wellness and Motherhood Support Instagram account. I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but she reached out to me and said that she was enjoying the podcast. And it really means a lot when people take the time to give me some feedback and tell me what they're enjoying and what they'd like to hear more. And I'd love to hear from you as well. So if you could reach out to me either by email, info@curiousneuron.com, or on Instagram @curious_neuron, let me know if you'd like to hear more of something or less of something. And if you'd like some little very short solo episodes as well, where I talk about a topic or cover some questions that I received on Instagram or, you know, from parents. It's really helpful to hear back from you. And please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes. That is important for us as well and helps us know that you are enjoying it. I would like to thank the Tannenbaum Open Science Institute at the Neuro here in Montreal for supporting the Curious Neuron podcast. The Neuro is the first health sciences institution in the world to commit to open science, an approach to research that ensures scientific knowledge is shared widely and transparently. Today, we're discussing sensory sensitivity with Laura Pettix from the OT Butterfly. She's the person that I've found that shares so much information around sensory sensitivity. And whenever I cover this topic, I usually get emails from parents saying that they had no idea that their child had these sensory sensitivities. And very often, we don't realize that there are these sensitivities and we overlook them. And we just see it as a behavioral problem with their child because they are screaming or crying or having these really big, intense tantrums or meltdowns. And they're having them several times a day. And it's hard to know why they're having them. And they're out of the blue or nowhere, according to us, when in the end, it really is their system that is overstimulated or understimulated. And it's hard for us to understand that. So if there are parents that are experiencing this within their homes, I hope that today's episode gives you enough information so that you could make a decision whether or not your child might have this and to reach out to an occupational therapist who specializes in sensory sensitivities and get the help that you need for your child. There are things that you could do within your home, and Laura will explain all of this. And she also offers a lot of help on her website, including a checklist. So you can visit her website at theotbutterfly.com. There's something that I've been covering on social media, in my stories or on posts, where I'm trying to bring the awareness to what really matters to a child. And the reason why I'm doing that is because I think that as a society, we place a lot of stress on ourselves when it comes to making sure that our children have everything that they possibly need to thrive. We want them to do well, obviously, and we think about toys or making sure that their education in preschool is the best and that they learn, you know, the academic stuff. That is important. I don't want to take or, you know, any importance away from it. But I think that we need to realize that it's a little bit more simple than that. In the end, what really matters for a child's brain development is the connection that we have with them and taking the time to be present with them. I'm sure if you think back to your own childhood and think of a good moment, a positive moment, something, an activity or something that you did with someone, and you think back to that moment, odds are you felt really special in that moment and it really connected and imprinted itself in your memory because of how present and how good you felt. And odds are that person was really connecting with you in that moment. And that's all our children need. The more that we connect with them, that they feel special, that they feel seen, the more their brain will develop in a way, you know, that the stress centers of the brain and the social emotional parts of the brain, they are looking for connection. And the most rewarding thing for the brain from infancy, from birth, is a connection with a caregiver, with a parent, with somebody that matters to us. In fact, when we do connect with an infant, those reward pathways of the brain, the VTA, ventral tegmental area, really lights up and activates because it is so rewarding to feel connected to someone. So let's keep that in mind this week when we feel that, you know, we might not be doing things right or wondering what else we can possibly do for a child. Let's step away from the housework for a moment, even if it's just 10 minutes a day, to stay connected with our child and to put our phones away, turn everything off, you know, TV off, and sit with our child 10 minutes and connect with them and be present with them. That will make a huge difference on your relationship. It might help with your stress because you're disconnecting from the dirty dishes that need to be washed or the paper that is due for work or whatever it is. Disconnect from everything for 10 minutes to connect with your child. That's the challenge of this week. Since I had my daughter with me before, I asked her this question, and I encourage you to ask your child the same question. So I'm recording this now and she's upstairs, but I did ask her this question earlier, and this is what she said. What are some things that mommy or daddy do with you that really makes you feel close to us and connected?
When they spend time with me, sometimes they take some time to be with me or cuddle a bit or take some time alone with me.
That was not rehearsed. I put her on the spot with the question because she wanted to be part of the podcast, and I could not have said it any more perfectly than she did. That's all our children want. Ask your child the question today. All right, let's move on to today's episode. I want to leave this part because it'll probably make you giggle. I often have bloopers when I'm recording the podcast, obviously, and I edit things out. But I'm going to leave this blooper in there because just hearing a child's laugh, you know, even if we're having a rough day, I thought I'd leave it in there for you. So I hope it's okay. I will see you on the other side of this interview. All right, let's move on to today. All right, let's move on. Bloopers. Hey, stop talking. Okay, can I say the ending? Let me see if I can make it, okay? All right, let's move on to today's episode without any bloopers, and I'll see you on the other side. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Curious Neuron Podcast. I am your host, Cindy Hovington, and today I am joined by Laura Pettix. Hi, Laura.
Hello, Cindy. How's it going?
Good. I feel like we've met before. I know we haven't, but like I think we've chatted and met online a few times now.
I know. That's the crazy world of social media and exactly. Instagram. I've met so many friends, mom friends, all over the world in the past couple years. And I'm like, I feel like I really know you.
Like if I see lunch. Yeah, before? Exactly. Yeah. If I'd see you at some point and we cross, I'd be like, hey, like an old friend. I know.
I've made many friends in Canada, and I keep joking, one day I'm going to move over there. So there I need someone to house me for a little bit.
Get ready for the snow. It's coming.
I do not know any. I've literally been to the snow like one time in my life. Oh my gosh. One time ever.
It's on its way. I'm excited to speak to you today about sensory processing disorder and all the other definitions and terms that we'll be talking about. Laura is an occupational therapist, and that is your specialty. If you'd like to learn more about her, we'll mention it again at the end, but you can visit her website at the OT Butterfly and also on Instagram. And sensory processing disorder and all of those terms are so complicated. Like I was telling you before we started recording, I always like, you know, dig into the literature and see what I could find. And I came out of my session, like my day yesterday, even more confused about all these terms. But it's such an important topic for parents to know, because I think it's one of those topics that, you know, hearing this information might make a difference for a parent who's seeing some of these symptoms with their child. So
let's start by understanding our topic today. Sensory blank, blank, blank. So yeah, what is sensory processing disorder and what are the sensitivities? What's the difference? And let's start with the basics.
Yes, let's start with the basics. So the first thing that I always tell people when I'm explaining sensory processing disorder is to explain what sensory processing is and to bring up the important fact that we are literally all doing the sensory processing all day, all night, all of us. Everyone is doing sensory processing. We're doing that right now. So that is our ability to take in the information from our external environment and also in our internal, in our body and in the sensations. And we are, our brain is perceiving it. It goes into our brain and it automatically decides and filters out and tells us what we need to pay attention to, if we need to do something to it, if we need to focus on it, if we can ignore it. And it's doing that all automatically. So right now I've got a really bright light in front of me. I've got some clutter in the corner of my room I'm trying to ignore. On another day, I might hear some footsteps. I might hear the gardeners outside. All of those are sensory inputs that send a signal to my brain. And my brain's like, okay, that's a sound. That's the gardener. That's a light. It's identifying what it is. And then it tells me if I need to do anything about it or if it's like, this is not important. You focus on your conversation with Cindy. Focus on the words in your brain. We're going to take care of this and let you ignore that. And all of that happens automatically. Mm. And it's not just about sounds. It's about the feeling. Like I can feel the seat beneath my leg if I thought about it. Mm-hmm. If I'm not thinking about it, you don't notice it. Mm. So your brain can pick and choose what to pay attention to. And you also need just the right amount of sensory input, lights, sounds, feelings, smells, to engage in your environment, to be alert, to focus on something, to feel what we call regulated, which is just right, or sometimes you'll hear OTs say organized, having your nervous system just organized and calm and just in the right space. So you need just the right amount of that. So if that's what our brain does automatically for sensory processing, a child or a person with sensory processing disorder has kind of either a roadblock or a hiccup, however you want to think about it, in the brain when it gets the messages from the environment. It can either not pick up enough information from the environment or it picks up too much. So then that affects how the brain identifies what it is. It might not know what it is. It might say, I don't know what that sound is. So I think it's dangerous. So we might need to pay attention to it, or we might need to run away from that, or we might need to cry. And if you go through your entire day like that, that can be very inefficient. It can be really hard to learn. It can be really hard to focus. So there's a few different profiles, but the gist of sensory processing disorder is that the brain is spending a lot more energy, a lot more time deciding what to do with that information and telling your body what to do with it. And whether it's telling your body to seek more of something or if it's telling your body to run away and hide and protect it from something, those are some of the common responses. So in sensory processing disorder, there's a few different profiles or like tiers. The main one that I'm always educating parents about is sensory modulation disorder, which is a type of sensory processing disorder. And modulation just means the way that your brain perceives the information. So it's either too much of something or too little of something. So that's when we have your sensory seekers or your sensory sensitive kids. So those are kind of the terms that meet parents in the daily life and they might be reading on Instagram. We don't talk too much about the diagnostic terms because that we would get the glazed over looks way more than we already do. And it's already really hard to explain it as its own. There are some other diagnostic profiles of sensory processing disorder that aren't talked about too much. There's one that has to do with posture, and there's one that has to do with the way that you like motor plan your body. And those are kind of separate profiles. So I always start with the modulation because typically those are the most common ones we see, and we usually work there first in order to help some of the other things. So there's three main profiles under sensory modulation disorder. There's
Sensory over-responsivity, which is also sensory sensitivity. There is sensory seekers, which is sometimes called hyposensitive, mean they need a lot more input to register that information. So they seek more of it. These are the ones that want more of the input, as opposed to sensory sensitive, who can't tolerate a lot of input and they are pushing it away or running away from it or crying. And then there's another one called low registration sensory. So they have like a high threshold, like a sensory seeker, meaning they don't register a lot of sensory input, but they don't always seek it out. So they kind of just like passively go through the environment and miss a lot of sensory cues. And the last thing I'll say before we move on is that I always get this follow-up question from parents. Can my child be like a little bit of everything? Yeah, you can have like a potpourri of all of the three profiles. You can see, I've seen a mix of everything, and it's actually pretty common to have, you know, a child who is sensory sensitive to sound, but they seek a lot of touch, or a child who seeks a lot of movement and they love a lot of touch, but they are very sensitive to smell. Like you could have a mix of everything, and we all have sensory quirks, which are things that we prefer or things that we dislike. I cannot stand mushrooms, no matter how many exposures I've had. I do not like mushrooms. I don't like loopy rides or super thrill rides. I'm so over-responsive to movement. Yeah. But I don't have sensory processing disorder or a significant sensory challenge, but those are my sensory quirks.
I'm putting myself in the shoes of someone listening now, and I have a million questions.
Yes, yes.
I think you're right. Even for me, being home with three kids, and I voiced this online on social media, sometimes at the end of the day, it wasn't a bad day, but by the end of the day, I've had so many kids like jumping on, like not jumping, but like in my arms or screaming if they had a good day and their energy is like really high. And all of a sudden, any little sound, not that it triggers me, but I respond very differently to it by the end of the day. So I'm glad that you mentioned that we all have our little quirks as well, because it doesn't necessarily mean that something is wrong, but we have our own individual levels, I guess, of
thresholds. Yeah. Thresholds. Yeah. Yes.
I love that. And now the second thing is I'm thinking of toddlers. Everything that you mentioned fits within what we saw in our home too with toddlers, where some responded immediately towards like the sound of the vacuum, or one of my three kids would mouth a lot of stuff until they were like, you know, close or even past three. And it seemed like they were seeking that sensation. So how can you, looking at those different profiles, can we perhaps paint a picture of what it would look like within a child and what they would be doing, so that a parent could better understand that?
Yeah. So let's talk first about the sensory over-responsivity. So those are our sensory sensitive kids. Sometimes they're also called sensory avoiders. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're called hypersensitive. All of that is the same sensory profile picture. They have a low threshold. And this means that the sensory input they get from the environment can feel more intense to them than what we feel. And so the best way to illustrate this and to think about is I always call them sensory cups. So we all have sensory cups, and sensory sensitive kids have a teeny tiny cup that gets overflowed. So anytime a cup is overflowing, you think of overstimulation, meltdown, fight or flight, big dysregulation type stuff. So if you can imagine a child with a small sensory cup, it gets filled very easily throughout the day. So let's talk about two different children, one is a sensory quirk and one is a sensory sensitive child. So let's take that example of the vacuum. So let's say it's like 2 years old. That's a common time, because maybe the vacuum is maybe new to them. They've probably seen their mom do that throughout their years, but a sensory quirk who dislikes the sound of the volume, they'll cry when with the vacuum is on. Maybe they'll run away. Maybe they'll cover theirs, because the vacuum can be kind of a loud sound depending on how close they are to the vacuum and all of that. And what brand vacuum you have. We're not going to be sponsored by a vacuum, but I feel like you can make an argument for like a very silent vacuum here. Yes. That sensory parents would love. But if you just have a regular vacuum that is, you know, pretty loud, a kid with a sensory quirk who finds it loud may cover the ears, may run away, But as soon as the vacuum turns off, they'll like wipe their tears or come back, and they might be even be curious about it. They could turn it on and off. And then the next few times that you do it, they'll probably decrease their sensitivity or find a way to talk about it or find a way to come back. They won't run away as much, even if it's still a little loud for them or they dislike the sound of it. A child with sensory processing disorder or sensory processing challenges who is sensitive to the vacuum will maybe have still cry and run, but that moment of dysregulation can extend for the rest of the day, even after you turn off the vacuum. So they maybe stop crying, but they might be on edge. They might be a little moodier. And then they might have like a big fear of the vacuum because it really gave them a visceral physical response. Their fight or flight response went off in their brain. It was dangerous to them. And so it kind of has this lingering dysregulation in them. And then it kind of is solidified by every time it happens. It's like, oh, that gave me that feeling again. That was way too loud. And now I'm going to start associating the vacuum with danger. So every time I even see the vacuum, I'm going to have a meltdown. Like it can very much extend and have ripple effect for much longer for kids with sensory processing challenges than with a sensory quirk.
Got it.
Yeah. So let's talk about then sensory seekers, which are, you know, in toddler years, they're very active. They do run, they do explore, they do put things in their mouth. So this is a really hard age. The under three age, this is why as occupational therapists, there's an entire field dedicated to the 0 to 3, which is early intervention. And this is not my specialty. So when I had my daughter who has sensory processing disorder, all of the under 3 years like was uncharted territory for me. People were like, well, don't you know you work with kids? I'm like, no, I work with kids 3 and up. This is, I have no idea if this is normal, if this is what's supposed to happen. So I was lost just like so many parents are. But over the years, after talking to people in that field and seeing my own daughter and seeing other kids her age, you can spot a child who is sensory seeking when you see them not be able to respond to your cues to like come back to this activity or to not even like acknowledge it because they're so engrossed in getting a lot of the input that they're not even like able to be satisfied from it. Like it would just continue and continue and continue. So these kids have a huge sensory cup. And I also say that the sensory cup has a hole in it. Like the more you fill it, it's just, you're never going to get that child's sensory system satisfied. Like they just need more and more and more. And this is a really hard profile to separate in toddlers as well as sensory sensitive, because you could see both behaviors in neurotypical children. But it really comes down to, when I'm interviewing a parent or having an intake call with them, I'll ask like, how does this look at the grocery store? Are there safety challenges here? Are they unable to even like pause for like 1 minute and standing in line with you? Are you constantly having to make sure that they're safe? They have zero impulse control, with a lot of toddlers don't. That executive functioning skill is like tiny at that age. But you can very clearly see a sensory seeker, like they just, with no safety awareness, no care for safety at all, because they just really want that intense input that they're seeking. And seeing how they are also in the classroom, if they're in a preschool classroom, see how this impacts them there. So it always comes back with like the environments and how they're able to participate at school or at home or in the community.
What you just said is really interesting, because I think if we change our lens, because the way that you just described that toddler, the grocery store, we might see it as this super energetic child who just can't sit down, especially at that age, versus if we change our lens and realize that they're seeking sensation through movement, then we're able to support them a little bit more rather than get, we might still get frustrated because we're at the grocery store, but we might be able to offer them a little bit of help. In terms of sensory seeking, now I understand the touch, and I could imagine, with the movement, but I'm also picturing a child who is still mouthing a lot of things and placing objects in their mouths. How would it look for somebody or a child who's seeking that visual or that sound? A child who screams a lot or has a very high tone, I guess, of volume, is that another way of spotting a child who's sensory seeking?
Yeah, so children who have like a high volume in their voice or are screaming often, there's a couple things that it could be. And this is a very multi-layered part, which is when it's important to have to be like screened by an OT. And I also grab a speech therapist at the same time for this, because if we're looking at what screaming does, or having a high volume of voice for this child, it can either be that they are seeking the sound, like they like the sound of their voice, they like being loud. They could be seeking the vibration of like talking and singing, and that sensation of humming or singing really loud or screaming. Mm. They could be not hearing their own voice. So a decrease in perception of sound and unable to modulate, decide how loud. It's either way too loud or like they could whisper, but that in between, really hard for them to do. So that might be a thing as well. It could be them drowning out the sound of the environment and they don't want to hear anything. And it's like that la 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 type thing, but they're not doing that. It's just they're constantly talking and filling that space. So there's a lot of, so anything like auditory wise, I always, if it's a little complicated and like other parts of the picture don't quite fit, I always refer to a speech therapist for a secondary like screening type thing and see if we can put the pieces together.
Got it. Yeah. Do you still have that? You used to have this free PDF on your website for a parent who might be listening now and saying, wait a minute, you know, I think my child sort of meets some of these criteria. Do you have that form still?
I have a checklist and it's specific to sensory sensitivity. So sensory sensitivity profile is very near and dear to my heart because my daughter has sensory sensitivity and I worked with a lot of clients with this, and this is the profile that I understand the most and it's what I coach parents through the most. But yeah, so I have a checklist on there that how you can kind of start to filter through some of the behaviors and see which parts of it fit. Is this just a sensory quirk or is this more of a challenge? And the real difference is, as you'll see in the checklist, if anyone wants to get it, it's at, I'll send you the link, but it's at theotbutterfly.com/checklist.
Got it. I'll add it to the show notes page for those who are listening. Okay.
Yeah. So it's checking things that like is sensitive to sound or dislikes going down a slide or is sensitive to clothes, all of the things that you might like see that they avoid, but the part that really says, okay, now this is when it's a sensory challenge is if you check off more than one box, right? If it's just one isolated area, like they don't like to wear jeans or they don't like the tags in their clothes, and that's like the only thing, I'm like, maybe more of a sensory quirk. So if you check off more than one of those things, but then also if you have these other big behavioral impact that impact like sleep, or they have huge meltdowns, like very big, long intensity, like longer than 20 minutes often, or if there's self-injurious behavior, those kinds of really big emotional challenges, then that plus being sensitive to a bunch of stuff is when I start my flags go off and say, maybe this is a sensory processing challenge thing.
And the diagnosing this, I think we could have a whole conversation around this.
Oh my gosh.
But now somebody who fills out this, you know, looks at this list and starts to check off a couple boxes, what are the next steps for them? Because from what I understand, this isn't in the DSM yet. Is it, right?
Like it's not. It's not. I know. And this is not because, so let's back up. So sensory processing disorder is not in the DSM. And the DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, right? So that's what it stands for. We're on the fifth edition right now. Yeah. I don't know when sixth is supposed to come out, but we're in the fifth edition. And as of now, sensory processing disorder does not have its own diagnosis, meaning there's not its own code. And you use this code to bill insurance. It will be on your patient chart. Like this patient has anxiety, which is code XYZ.3 or whatever that is, right? There's a code next to it. Sensory processing disorder is not in the in the DSM as a standalone disorder. So you will see it listed as a symptom or as a part of things like autism, anxiety, ADHD. Recently, I've been learning about FASD, which is the fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. I think that's in the DSM.
Yes, it is.
It's part of that. So that's what I've been adding to that too, but it doesn't have its own thing. And it's not because there's not research, because there is. They have a lot of neuro research, brain imaging studies that actually show that there are brain differences, the structure of the white matter in brains of children who have, quote, suspected SPD, because again, there's no diagnosis, based on reports from their parents. It looks different in those kids versus kids who have autism or kids who have ADHD or neurotypical kids. There is a very specific way that the brain looks in children with SPD, and it also matched and correlated with their parents' responses on how they filled out a behavioral form, which is really great, right? And that was all the way in 2013, and there's still more and more research coming out to solidify that. But I don't know if anyone here works for the DSM. I don't know who decides all that.
Yeah.
But can we get on that, please? So yeah. Even, so that's
I read this study that spoke about the parasympathetic system as well, where there's it's like not functioning as well, right? So back to that fight or flight, that's why it's impacting all of those sensations and your body doesn't know how to respond and perhaps sees the vacuum, like you said, as something I need to run away from. There's so much research around it, but it's confusing.
It's very confusing. There's a particular study that I saw. It was from 2011. So this was back in when it was the DSM-4. Mm. So still no SPD, obviously. This was before the fifth version. But they found that, like, I think it was a quarter. So like 25% of kids, specific with sensory over-responsivity, right? I have a lot of research on that because that's what I focused on. So kids who are sensory sensitive, they found that 25% of the kids who met a certain threshold for like elevated responses to sensory sensitivity, meaning they were like crying from the vacuum or like not being able to tolerate messy play, all of the things, 25% of them had overlapping criteria for DSM-4 diagnoses. So 25% of them, yes. But then what does that say about the 75% of them that also met that had those elevated over responsivity but did not meet criteria for that? Mm-hmm. That means they are separate from neurotypical kids because they had elevated responses and they were the same as those that had other diagnoses, but they didn't have anything. So they didn't fit. And so what happens then is the medical world, the medical profession, usually pediatricians, if they're not super on board with sensory processing, you'll go to them and say, hey, my child is running from the vacuum. He's having 3 meltdowns a day. He's doing this. What happens is if your child doesn't check all the boxes for anxiety, or if your doctor's like, well, your child doesn't have autism, so it must not be a thing, or you'll just get some run of the mill. That's normal. They might grow out of this, or they'll give you like parenting tips that as if like you haven't tried anything, right? And as if those will work. But that, I get that story so often. And I'm like, it's 2021, people. Can we please get with it? I understand it's not a diagnosis in this manual, but research is showing that it exists. So the very complicated answer, parents are always like, well, how can I get the SPD diagnosis? I'm like, well, you can't, one. And then two is it's more important to get your child's sensory processing abilities assessed, which an occupational therapist can do. So we have questionnaires that are norm referenced that we can, and standardized, that we can tell what is considered typical and what deviates from the norm in terms of your child's behaviors. And so we can say that this is, you know, way above average response to sound. So they might have a challenge with that. Mm-hmm. OTs, and this is also a common misconception, OTs cannot diagnose anything. It's not within our scope of practice. We cannot make a diagnosis. So you won't get a diagnosis from your OT. But OT is typically the first step or first place to go to get your sensory processing skills evaluated, so that they can provide sensory integration. So then the hiccup becomes, how can I get this reimbursed by insurance if it's not a diagnosis? And that's, like you said, a whole other conversation. Mm. So, yeah.
So if I guess this is one of those cases where we need to be the advocate for our children. And if we know something is off, because we usually do know deep inside something is off.
Yeah.
And it also goes back to when I tell parents, like, every tantrum, or in this case, even a meltdown, is a way of communicating something, so a need that they don't have, they can't express it yet, or they might not even know what's going on. So if we step back and we do take the time to really identify what they're trying to communicate, we might realize, hey, they're having these meltdowns after the TV has been on for a certain amount of time, or after I turned on the vacuum, or maybe around a meal time where there's that sensation, right? And the texture that is triggering something. But now I'm picturing a parent who says, okay, I've clearly identified something is off. I went on Laura's website, downloaded the list, spoke to my doctor about it. Doctor says it'll pass. No other signs of autism or ADHD or anxiety. Now what? How? I don't know how it is in the States. I know here in Canada, sometimes we need referrals, or else we can't really access those pediatric specialists like yourself. Is it up to us to find, can we reach you? Are there people that we can reach now online that we could at least have a conversation with to take those next steps and at least provide our child with support? At this point, if we can't get the diagnosis, you know, that's the way our system wonderfully works, in quotes.
I know.
Can we get some help for a child?
Yeah. So I do want to insert a little thing here for when you are going to your pediatrician. So not all pediatricians are like what I'm talking about, but majority of them are still not totally on board with the whole thing about SPD. So if you anticipate that's going to be your provider's response and your child is clearly not have any of these other diagnoses, then I always tell parents to bring video, picture, and like a specific objective log of like, on Tuesday, he had a meltdown for 93 minutes before 8 a.m. and also at 3 p.m. and at 5 p.m. During this meltdown, he bit his finger. He drew blood from biting me, like very specific things. So that that you're like literally bringing the data and say like, is this normal, doctor? Yeah. Like you not just saying my 2-year-old is having meltdowns, because yes, you will be met with, well, welcome to two, because that's like when you just say that, that's what you get response. But if you like really lay it out, the other thing, which I heard someone mention to me was a really good trick is, so if you specifically say, so my child has these sensory challenges, I would like a referral to occupational therapy, please, doctor. And if they say, I don't think so, it's not worth it, whatever. Okay, can you please document that I have asked for a referral and you are not giving it to me? And I've heard that just like, can you document that I've asked for it and you said no? We'll just be like, okay, fine. If you want it, then I will give it to you. I've heard that's a very good trick, which is like makes sense, but it's like, yeah, I want it in the chart that at 2.5, I've identified this thing and you're saying no. So let's say that they still say no and you can't get the like direct service to OT. So you can also, I don't know what, if they have this in Canada, I'm sure they do, but it's probably a different set of regulations. But if your child is under 3, you can get early intervention services through your county. So if you're in the United States, you search early intervention regional center and then like type in like your county. So I'm like in Orange County, so I would type in early intervention regional center Orange County, and then it'll give you a phone number. So you call and tell them your what you're seeing, and they will send someone to your house to evaluate your child for free. It's just that you have to be very upfront. If it's just sensory needs, sometimes they won't have a specialist to look at those sensory needs, or and then the other thing is your child has to meet a certain threshold to be able to get services from there. But at the very least, if you are working with like no support, having a professional just at least come so you could talk these things out. And then if they say your child doesn't qualify for services, but like try these, they usually have like a next step thing that would help. So do they have something like that in Canada?
I don't even know, actually.
I think I've heard something like that in Canada, but it was like up to age 5. I thought that. I don't know if I'm making that up.
If there is anything, I'll put it up on the show notes.
But yeah.
I know originally I'm in the province of Quebec here, and I know that we have the CLSC. So those of you who are listening, I know that there's a free line that we can call to speak to a nurse directly, but I don't know if they offer the services of coming over to have any sort of quick evaluation.
Right. Okay, so that's an option. So then the other option is to, if you don't, if maybe like, let's say you don't know what these behaviors are and you're not quite sure they are sensory related, but there's definitely something going on. You can go to a developmental pediatrician. And I don't know if you need a referral from your MD, but I find that they, I had an easier time getting a referral to developmental pediatrician versus straight to an OT. But what a developmental pediatrician is what they sound like. They have a specialty in cognitive disorders, mental health disorders, developmental disorders, and they basically all they do is evaluate. So they don't treat, but they evaluate, and then they like triage you to where you belong. Like, okay, your child would probably benefit from speech therapy, from PT, check with a play therapist. So they kind of can, they can recommend to OT as well.
Got it. Okay. And then here, I think what's similar to that is a neuropsychologist. For those who are in Canada, I think you can ask for a referral for a neuropsychologist from your doctor, and then they do those evaluations too, if you can access a psychologist or an OT and so on. Now, what happens, what are the next steps once this happens? Is there a sort of treatment that your child has to, you know, have, or is it a way, do you just learn how to support your children through these moments?
Yeah. So it's really, sensory integration is the treatment, is the way to provide the child with all of the experiences from like a sensory perspective in a graded and an adaptive way so that they can start to have more regulated responses to that. And so this typically happens in a sensory integration clinic, because that's when you'll see all of the swings and all of the big sensory input that they're allowed to offer at the clinic. But they do have sensory integration therapists who can come to your house. You can do all of that. But definitely the parent support is the part where I find there's a big gap in our field. And this comes from, obviously, like with a lot of healthcare and educational fields, there's just like a lack of resources. Therapists are burnt out. They have huge caseloads where they barely get any time really to debrief with parents, especially in the clinic. So if you have a therapist who can go to your home, that's great, because then you can be there as part of it. You can learn with them. You're kind of, you're enmeshed with a therapist, and you can overlap with them. But there's a lot of clinics where their therapists are like given 5 minutes at the end of each session to tell the parents what we did, right? Five so that's minutes. How that's how it was. Yeah, that's how it usually is. 5 minutes to be like. And then after 5 minutes, it's like, well, we did this obstacle course. We did this. We did this. We did this. And then the parent's like, oh, okay, well, what should I do at home? And then we're giving them a suggestion, but it's all in very disjointed things. And then when your child is there at the end of the session, it's just so chaotic. Like, I've been at this side of it as a parent who brought my child to OT. And I've also obviously been the clinician. So I started in my practice, and this isn't a standard, but I started my practice when I evaluate a child and I talk to their family, I start recommending one every month doing a parent consult or like a parent conference where we can have uninterrupted like 1 hour where we can talk at length about what's going on, progress we're making, goals we're working on, and then like the educational part about what this even means and why it's really important. And then giving them suggestions on what to do at home. Because what I've found is if we just give parents this like sheet of things that you can do, especially when it's like crab walk and all of these like funny like obstacle courses and like deep tissue massages or things that we like suggest or blow bubbles, parents are like, "What? Okay, like cool. Why? But yeah, okay, like I'll try it." But I find there's much more of a lack of follow through when they don't understand why they have to do this or what this is going to contribute to their child's sensory development. So that parent education piece is very, very important in the whole scope of occupational therapy and sensory integration with a child who has sensory processing disorder.
I could imagine just how much education, you know, because it's the whole environment. It's, you know,
it opens up a whole world. Yeah. When I like reframe like what the school day looks like for the parents, and I'll like list off all of the little sensory triggers that they're like, I didn't even think that was a trigger. It's so little. I'm like, yeah, the sound of the air conditioner, that constant sound can be a huge trigger for your sensory sensitive child. And it's stuff that we take for granted. We don't even notice because our brain filters that out. Yeah. But for them, they don't. And then it, so I start it, the biggest light bulb I get, the first success that I get with a client is not with the child itself. It's with the parents having that light bulb moment. And then that brings so much more empathy and insight. And then that in turn then improves their relationship with their child, which at this point, before they've seen me, they just thought their kid was like a bad kid.
Yeah,
or like,
I get it.
Why aren't you listening? So that empathy piece and those light bulb moments in the early parts of working with the family are so inspiring and so like, it's so rewarding to see that up front, and it's so important.
I could imagine also as a parent going through this and finally getting support, the overload, the mental overload and the mental health aspect on the parent themselves too, because if you're dealing with these meltdowns multiple times a day, every single day, that's hard. It takes up their energy, takes up yours. Can we talk a little bit about that? Like the parents you've spoken with, I mean, how are they, how kind of support do you provide for them as well? And I think we should also touch upon the meltdown a little bit more, because maybe a parent is listening to this, and you had a week on this on Instagram that I loved, because you're highlighting the difference between that tantrum and the meltdown. So first let's talk a bit about the parents and then get into meltdowns a little bit more.
Yeah. So when I consult with parents and I talk to them, one of the first things that I offer is that validation that yes, you're not imagining this. The thing about SPD is it's such an invisible disorder, because your child is verbal. They're able to be really charming, and they're able to like I hear this all the time, even from my family, like, what? She has this disorder? Like, she doesn't seem like it. I'm like, yes, she does. So you're constantly having to prove something about your child, and it's invisible. So giving them that validation that what you're seeing, you are 100% correct. Mm. Your gut was right. So that validation is important. And then also, I mean, telling them that validation, then what comes with it is like, you're not alone. Like, I know that parents, I hear it all the time. I felt like I was the only one who was dealing with this. Mm. And then providing them with the support to help them through, like, so there's like a plan of like, this is baby steps to help your child meet certain milestones or to like improve their functioning in a certain area. But what can we do now for you today to get through the rest of this week so that you're not literally just like pulling your hair out?
Yeah, you,
so
exactly. Not the child, but you.
Exactly. Because that's why I love OT, because it's a whole family centered thing. Like the parents are just as much my clients as the child is. And so that setting that part up and letting parents know that I'm here for them to support them as well is a huge piece of it. And that's why I think OT is so important. But that's why also parent consulting and working with the parents can make a huge difference. But that the other thing that I've been doing a lot more recently, especially when I work with moms, is planting the seed or recommending that mom see a therapist, because this can be such a huge burden, a huge like mental load. I think there's a whole I don't want to say disorder, but there's a whole thing with being a millennial parent raising a young child through a pandemic. Like, I've heard the term millennial parent from someone recently on a podcast, and was like, and they talked about what we've been raised through, the things that in our world that we've been through as we grew up, and how that impacts our own mental health and our view of the world and how we parent. And then we have to do it through a pandemic. Mm-hmm. So there's just like, I can't recommend therapy enough. So when I really, really sit down and talk to the parents, and I can tell, like, particularly the moms, I will always say, like, this is a really good supplement to OT, because you're going to hit your ceiling very quick. Yeah. Even if I give you all the information, I know you're not going to be in a space to apply it, because I've been there too, where I've like been like, okay, my daughter has this. I'm going to consult with the behaviorist. I'm going to consult with the psychologist. I'm going to consult with this. And I wanted more information, and I got it and I learned it, but I literally was not in a space to even do anything with it. Mm. And then I'm like, well, now what do I do? I know what I'm supposed to do, but I just cannot do anything right now. So that's when therapy kind of like helped me move past that. So that's a big piece of it.
Even during a moment of a tantrum or a meltdown, even a child who doesn't have any sensory processing disorder, a tantrum could be a trigger for us. You know, if it's a third or fourth tantrum of the day, and we are struggling with regulating our own emotions, you know, therapists can help us, provide us with some tips so that we can apply that during the moment. And I can't even imagine if this is lasting an hour and a half. And you have to regulate yourself the entire time and try to support them as well.
I know. Yeah. It's really hard. It is a long game. And I can say that I am not perfect and that I aim like for 80% of my week. Mm. I either do, I go for the 80% of like the week or 80% of the meltdown. If I could say regulated for 80% of it, I'm near the end. Yeah. So it's not always that bad, but like sometimes it really is like it's, and there's sometimes where I'm just like, I'm not regulated enough to do this. Mm. I have to like just throw in the towel and try something, but it's tough.
Yeah. How is it with your experience as well? And you said you were seeing an OT as well for your daughter. Over time, does it get a bit easier? I'm thinking of a parent now who might be going through the process. Is there a light? Is there, you know, enough support at some point that things get a little bit easier for them?
Yeah, there's definitely a few lights at the end of the tunnel, and you'll get through that tunnel and you might like graduate OT or not need support. And then you might go through another tunnel, another dark tunnel, another part of development. Yeah. So the thing with SPD and what I love, there's an author called Carol Kranowitz, and she's the author of The Out of Sync Child. And that's like my number one book that I recommend parents. If you're just starting your SPD journey, this is the perfect book because it's actually not written by an OT. She's a teacher, but she explains sensory processing in such a digestible way that I love it. But she says that SPD is something, is not something that you grow out of, but it's something you grow into, which I love because neurologically speaking, if you have a neurodivergent brain, which is a child who has sensory processing disorder, most likely your brain will continue to process things in that way, which is a different way. It diverges from the typical brain. However, with OT, with your parents' support, with accommodations in the classroom, and with learning self-regulation techniques, you find tools and strategies. You, as a person with SPD, you find ways to accommodate your lifestyle, to be successful in your lifestyle with those changes to your schedule or with those extra sensory tools. And you just learn to start becoming more independent in advocating for yourself and then also just regulating yourself. You learn what works for your body. Yes, to some extent, sensory integration, the idea is hopefully, while the brain is still pretty plastic in young childhood, that you can reroute some of those sensory neurons and create more efficient pathways, so to speak. The more often you get that pathway, the stronger it gets, right? So ideally, yes, there might be some changes in the brain. But we just say that, you know, so my example I always do is if you have a sensory seeker now who's like 4 or 5 years old, just cannot stop sitting, cannot stop moving, they might not find a 9-to-5 cubicle job. Maybe they're going to be like a tour guide. Maybe they're going to be a skydiver instructor. Maybe, you know, like they will find a thing that works for them. You have a child who is a heavy work seeker and they love pushing, pulling, crawling, things that just like really intense input. Maybe they'll be a fitness instructor. Maybe they'll be, you know, a sports therapist and they'll work with a lot of athletes. Like there's so many routes. And then that they can kind of build their life around because they know what their body responds to best and what doesn't respond to best. And then they've learned the tools to regulate their body.
So it's important not to ignore it and think that it'll go away because you want to offer them those tools.
And it's so important to keep your child in the loop when you're doing these sensory strategies. That's the one key that I think is important for parents to understand is not just like, let's just do this obstacle course because it's fun, or let's go do, let's do bubbles. Let's do this craft. Let's do this, whatever activity or sensory bin that you have. Mm. Because it's fun. Yes. But if your child is a certain age, like I would say even like 3 and up or any child that you can have effective communication with, it's important to be like, is this making your body feel calm? Or you know how your body kept moving really, really fast in the living room? And then after you helped me put the laundry away with all that heavy work, your body's moving a little slower. Mm. And we were able to sit down and have lunch together. Yeah. That's so cool. So you're like piecing it together because you have to keep them in the loop or you're not going to get them to self-regulate if you're just giving them these fun activities without explaining it to them.
Got it. You mentioned heavy work now a couple of times. Can we dig a little bit deeper into that? Because a parent might be wondering what that is.
Heavy work is magic. Literally, it's just magic. I have period. Heavy work is magic. heavy work is a form of proprioceptive input. And proprioceptive input is actually one of the like hidden senses that we don't think about, right? If we think about senses, if I asked a parent to name the senses, they would probably name the five, right? Mm-hmm. Then sight, smell, sound, taste, and touch, which is five sensory inputs. There's actually eight mm-hmm. sensory systems. And proprioceptive is one of the extra ones. And this is the receptors are in your muscles, in your tendons, and in your joints. So anytime you have active resistance against gravity to your muscles, tendons, and joints, which is like pulling, pushing, carrying, jumping, chewing is proprioceptive input. Anytime you have that kind of input, it's very inherently regulating to the nervous system. And so this is one of the sensory profiles that I always say, it's almost impossible. I still have yet to see this documented. I'm always searching for it, but I have never seen this in my practice. And I've asked very seasoned therapists, have you ever seen a child who is sensitive to proprioceptive input, like just proprioceptive input? And they're like, no, I don't think I have. Because, well, first of all, sensory input, proprioceptive input is very much tied to tactile input. So it's very rare to see it just isolated. Okay. But also heavy work can be regulating for a sensory sensitive child. So if you're nervous, if you're too sensitive to like touch, if you're sensitive to movement, we say do heavy work. That'll regulate you and get you calm, get your nervous system a little bit more regulated and organized. If you have a sensory seeker who cannot sit still, who can't stop moving, and they're just disorganized, like running around the room, impulsive, not listening to things, heavy work can also regulate them. So it's like you literally cannot go wrong with heavy work, aside from medical precautions of like can't lift a certain weight.
Yeah. But,
like, heavy work, which by the way, can be something very little like body weight. So like squeezing your hands is heavy work. Pushing a laundry basket with like a couple books in it mm-hmm. or clothes in it is heavy mm-hmm. work. For my daughter right now, she's four. Having her help me open the car door with two hands is heavy work for her because it's yeah. And so heavy work is like, if you can find little ways to sneak in heavy work throughout your day, you'll have a much more regulated child, whether they are sensitive or if they're a seeker.
I guess that's the one tip. Any parent that has a toddler right now, they're like, hold on a second. Where's my
If you take one thing away, heavy work. And the thing about heavy work is so many household chores involve heavy work. Mm. And if you have a toddler, like soak this up because they love mm-hmm. helping. They love helping. And if you think like, okay, my goal is not to get my child to actually like sweep the floor like properly. Like I will probably have to end up like vacuuming this all up at the end. But if you can get them involved in the sweeping mm-hmm. Or like even scooting the chairs back away from the table. If you have a two-year-old, that's heavy work, right? Yeah. Have them help you wash the windows. Pushing a rag up and down on the sliding doors, that's heavy work. Oh, yeah. Favorite one is laundry. Mm-hmm. Collecting the laundry, even having them like squat and then throw it to the top. If you have like a top loading mm-hmm. washer, there's so many ways to integrate heavy work. Making the bed, taking the pillows off the bed, putting them on the bed. Mm-hmm. All of those things is heavy work. If you have any active resistance against your muscles and your tendons and your joints, it's heavy work. Obviously, some kids will want more intense of it. Like they'll want actually like jumping, which provides proprioceptive input. Mm-hmm. But the best way too is chores around the house. And my other secret is animal walks. So like frog hops, crab walks, bear mm-hmm. crawls, all of that provides proprioceptive input to your hands and to your shoulders if you're weight bearing.
Yeah.
And it's providing all of that input there. Wheelbarrow walks is a really good one too. So it can make like a boring morning routine so much more engaging. Like, okay, it's time to go put your shoes on. Do you want to walk like a crab or do you want to wheelbarrow walk to go to the closet to get your shoes? And then it's like, well, now, yeah, I want to do that instead of just say, let's go get the shoes. So it helps in a lot of ways.
How fun is that, right? For the child, it's like, what? Like, you want me to walk like a crab? Sure, I can do that.
Yeah, yeah, it's awesome.
That's why it's magic.
It's magic, and it's so regulating. This is like, if you're an adult, like this is like what yoga provides for you, mm-hmm. or like literally like heavy lifting. So there's some people, I mean, I'm not one of them, but there's some people who like love that heavy work and like feel so regulated and calm from it, and they want more of it. So these are the people who like do yoga every single day or weightlift mm-hmm. every day. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Got it. Wow. You've provided so much information. I'm so happy that we had this discussion. Before we go, I have to bring up, because I've been meaning to talk to you about it, Walt Disney.
Oh my.
I look at your stories.
Let's talk about this.
And I'm just, I like try to live like through you and like, oh, I want to be there.
However, it's magical.
The reason why I'm bringing this up is because I think you're doing something pretty interesting there by taking notes. So let's take a child who is sensory sensitive and putting them in these amusement parks, right? In these big parks. What have you experienced and why did you start taking down notes now about this?
Yeah, so I am in California, so I go to Disneyland, and so I have a pass there, so I go off and out. Now I bring my daughter, who has sensory processing disorder and anxiety, and I realized how hard it is for her to literally just, like, wait in line for something, which you can say for any kid, like, kids don't like waiting, but when you see an SPD child or an anxious child in line, it's a whole other ballgame. Mm. So I saw how much just literally that anticipation and waiting in line impacted her ability to then enjoy the ride itself. And remember, she has a small sensory sensitive kids. So I needed to get her on the ride with as empty of a cup as possible because those rides are so overstimulating.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's a part of me that's like, I know you're going to love this ride because you love Winnie the Pooh and you love Ariel and you love all of the themes, but it's also super loud and super dark and it has like a bumpy motion, which is so overstimulating. And that's just the ride. When you're walking around a theme park, there are a ton of sounds. It is very overstimulating. Mm. I don't think any even neurotypical parent or neurotypical child would argue the fact that Disneyland is overstimulating.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So once I started documenting and I found some strategies to make our trips successful, I started and sharing this on Instagram. I started hearing from a lot of parents that was like, I literally have like already come to terms with the fact that I don't think I'll be able to take my child to Disneyland or Disney World because of their SPD or because of autism or because of whatever it is, because like it would literally be so miserable for me. Mm. And I was like, oh, that makes me so sad that you feel like you can't bring your child, but I get it.
Yeah,
but because I live so close by and I in my head was like, well, I could leave if it gets too hard, but there's some families who have to plan an entire vacation, hotels, like accommodations, all of that just to go. And so they're nervous that it's not going to work out as well if they have a child who's neurodivergent. So I started documenting, and it's a project that I'm working on that I love because now I have another excuse to go to Disneyland. I literally am at Disneyland like twice a week. So I'm starting to rate all of the rides based on a scale, like how loud this ride is, how much movement this ride has, how dark it is. And there's a lot of things that like Disneyland does not take into consideration. So they have recommendations on their app that's like, this ride is loud or this ride is a little dark. But like when I go on it, I see so many other things where I'm like, okay, this is loud and dark, but there was a birthday party scene on this ride and there was a storm scene, which I know a lot of anxious kids or sensory sensitive kids are triggered by the sight of a birthday cake because people sing and they don't like the sound of it. Like there's so many things that like I know, I'm like, oh, my client XYZ would not be okay with this ride. And what this does for a parent, if you don't know going on to it, you just see Winnie the Pooh ride. There's no height limit. So yeah, I can take my 3-year-old on this ride. No. And then if it sets off their fight or flight, the rest of their day is not going to go well or smooth at all. So my dream, my new project that I'm working on is to make it so that parents don't have to fear going to Disneyland or like write it off if they really want to go, that there are steps and strategies you can do to try to make it more tolerable for the whole family. And that's like building in sensory breaks or at least knowing what to expect on certain rides so you can make a more educated plan when you go.
Got it. Thank you. I love that you're doing this. And I just, like I said, I'm enjoying watching you being there.
Yeah.
I like office ever.
Exactly. I'm like, wait a second. Like when I first figured that out, I was like, wait a second. Did I just make my entire childhood dreams come true?
Yes, exactly.
Being Disneyland and like my actual job. And I'm like, I don't have to work at Disneyland. Like I just get this is amazing. So yeah, I'm really excited about that. I love it.
I'm excited to see like the notes that you take and what comes out of that. But it's such a cool project.
Yeah.
I think you're awesome.
I think you're awesome too. I love talking to you.
I love chatting with you. We have to do this again. I can't believe I waited till season 3 to talk to you, but we'll definitely have to have a follow-up and see what questions come out of this. But where can we reach you? I know that now we can also listen to you on your new podcast. Just give us all the information because I know everybody's going to want to know more.
Yes. So the best place to reach me where I respond mostly is Instagram. So at the OT Butterfly, I'm on there all the time. I have a lot of content for you to binge. I have a highlight on there called SPD FAQ. So that's like a good highlight bubble to start with. But I do have a podcast that's out now. So if you search, well, you could just go to theotbutterfly.com/podcast and there's a bunch of links for which podcast player you have. But my podcast title is the Sensory Wise Solutions Podcast for Parents. And Sensory Wise Solutions is actually my parent program where I coach parents of sensory sensitive children on how to support their kids at home. So if you're interested in that, you could also DM me there. And yeah, I think those are the best places to find me. So I'll be on Instagram. And if you DM me and say hi, tell me that you came from the podcast. I always love hearing how people find me. But I will have to have you on my podcast one day when I get brave enough to tackle the interview
strategy. But you know what? Just do it. Just start it. Don't wait. First interview, I've mentioned this on the podcast, but my first interview, I was holding up my cell phone to this mic. Because I didn't know Zoom at that point. I didn't know how to do this. And I just held it here. And you learn as you go. And I think that those of you, those that are listening, they know that I'm super socially awkward and I don't like, I'm uncomfortable with small talk. It's kind of funny to them because like I'm on Instagram and I talk, but I'm planned, right? I have my notes, everything is planned.
Oh, yeah.
I'm comfortable that way versus the small talk. But with you, it's just like I said, it's like we're friends that I friend I haven't seen in a long time.
I know. I know.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I can't wait to speak to you again. And like I said, also at the beginning, maybe we did have one of those mental health talks and I think we have to have one of those again. So we'll post about that online. Follow us. You can follow Curious Neuron at curious_neuron and follow Laura at the OT Butterfly on Instagram. Thank you, Laura.
Yay. Thanks for having me.
If you like listening to my mommy's podcast, please rate it on iTunes. And leave a review. Thank you.